A new social media campaign is targeting celebrities who haven't spoken out against what's happening in Gaza. But is it working?
The sort of block out movement is a lot more about the shifting attitudes towards celebrity than it is about really achieving anything. Because yes, Kim Kardashian has lost followers, and there are some cases where celebrities are seeing a dent. But I think this movement misunderstands how traditional celebrities make most of their money.
I'm Taylor Lorenz, and we'll be talking about the celebrity blockout this week on Power User.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.
From CAFE and the Vox Media Podcast Network, this is Stay Tuned in Brief. I'm Preet Bharara. The United States, as you know, faces some significant economic challenges. Income inequality is the highest of all developed nations. College tuition has increased annually since the 80s. And millions of Americans worry about affording their rent, let alone buying a home. So how can Americans begin to think about building wealth when the system seems so stacked against them? My guest, Scott Galloway, has founded 9 companies. He's a professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and a fellow podcaster at Vox Media. He's also written 5 books. His latest book, The Algebra of Wealth, A Simple Formula for Financial Security, came out last week and offers readers advice on how to build wealth and succeed in today's economy. Scott Galloway, welcome back to the show.
The dreamy Preet Bharara, finally. Finally, you bring me on.
You've been on. You've filibustered here before.
Yeah. So, all right, just a real quick story. Someone asked me what I was most proud about a few weeks ago on a pod, and I said, well, you know, my kids and, you know, graduating college, blah, blah, blah. And I said, also, in the last 3 years, 3 people have called me late at night, and they start with, I'm in jail. And why am I proud of that? I'm proud that when my friends, kids, and occasionally a friend thinks this shit's real, I got to call someone that I trust, is smart, has resources, and can help me figure this out, that they called me. I see that as a huge compliment. Anyways, do you know who my number is, who I plan to call should that happen to me?
I hope it's me.
You are my number. So my brother, keep your phone on at night because there's a non-zero probability I make some really stupid
decision. I'm surprised
that
you haven't called me many times already.
Yeah, but I'm not.
Given what I know about you, I am not joking.
If that ever happens to me, I have your number. I've just pulled it up now. I'm not going to obviously say what your number is, but you are my call, Preet.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. Can I start with a simple question? Your book?
Sure.
The Algebra of Wealth. Why algebra? Why not calculus? Why not the trigonometry of wealth? This is my first question.
I don't know. It sounds cooler. It's really an
Does
equation.
It?
You don't like algebra? I think it's cool. I actually just signed a 3-book deal, or I'm about to, for the algebra of masculinity, the algebra of work, and the algebra of mating. I like to try and attack what I think are complicated concepts and try and distill it down to a few behaviors that people can hold on to. So I use the term algebra, and I try and distill it down to an equation.
You think life is given to equations?
Well, no, but I think humans have an easier time holding on to things when they have a construct. So I think when in my class, I've taught 5,500 students, and whenever I see alumni, they pull out like the clock model, the thermometer model. I have all these models for brand management and strategy around how to make decisions. And humans have been, you know, using constructs and metaphors and visualization to hold on to ideas. So for me, it's trying to come to, you know, turn it into an equation such that you have this tool you can pull out of your quiver and say, all right, if I practice these 4 or 5 things or remember these principles, I'll be able to achieve, you know, X, Y, and Z. So it's just a means of trying to help people actualize or make these concepts actionable.
You say X, Y, and Z because you spend time in London, I take it.
There you go. Yes. Yes, that's right.
Do you say Gen Z or do you say Gen Z?
Gen Z. Yeah, I guess I say Gen Z. I don't know.
I'm going to give you some principles of syntax maybe that you can you can use. We're going to get to your formula because I think it's very interesting that you talk about in the book. But before we do that, can you lay bare where we are at this moment? You say in your book, quote, the median home price in the U.S. is 6 times the median annual income. 50 years ago, it was 2 times. and the share of first-time buyers is barely half the historical average and the lowest on record. Medical debt is the leading cause of consumer bankruptcy. Half of American adults would not be able to cover a $500 medical bill without taking on debt. Marriage, you go on and on and on. How bad of a position are individual Americans in at this moment?
Well, it depends who you're talking about. So if you have a college degree, your probably life is, you know, is pretty good. If you have the right certification, keep in mind, only one in three Americans achieves a college degree. Every economic policy I see is essentially just a thinly veiled transfer of wealth from the young to the old. People over the age of 70 are 72% wealthier than they were 40 years ago. People under the age of 40 are 24% less wealthy. The two biggest tax deductions, capital gains and mortgage interest. Who owns homes and sells, you know, makes money selling stocks? People my age who are wealthy, who earns their money from current income and rents, people younger. The $35 billion child tax credit expansion gets pulled out of the infrastructure bill, but the $135 billion 9% cost of living adjustment in Social Security flies through Congress. So in the great intergenerational theft of the last century was COVID, specifically the CARES Act, where we took $7 trillion, flushed it into the economy. 85% of the people who received it didn't spend it. So it ended up in the markets, which sent housing prices and stocks skyrocketing, which is great for the incumbents, the people like me who already own stocks and homes, but terrible for new entrants. Young people have kind of given up on owning a home. Between 2019 and 2024, the average cost of an American home went from $290,000 to about $410,000. The mortgage rate has gone from $1,100 to $2,200 because of an increase in interest rates. So we've gone from two-thirds of Americans can afford a home to less than one-third. So education skyrocketed, housing skyrocketed, and their average wages on an inflation-adjusted basis have actually gone down. So for the first time in our nation's history, a 30-year-old man or woman isn't doing as well as his or her parents were at 30. And I think that's the ultimate incendiary that turns every problem we have from a cut into an opportunistic infection. Young people are upset, and they have every right to be because they see prosperity everywhere that they're not sharing in.
How'd that happen?
We elected the cross between the Golden Girls and the Walking Dead, and they do a great job of representing seniors. The largest transfer in history of capital happens every year from young people to old people called Social Security, and I'm not suggesting.
Well, look, but it's interesting that you're sort of positing that as a negative. Other people would say that the most successful anti-poverty policy in the history of the country was the creation of Social Security because you had people who were older in this country who were in abject poverty and didn't have a social web, you know, to catch them. Are you saying it's gone too far?
It is the most successful program in history. And, you know, give me $1.5 trillion a year to shove at anything and I'll make it the most successful program in history. The question is, where do we go from now? Or from here, seniors are the wealthiest generation in history. What I'm suggesting is Social Security should be based on who needs it, not on whether or not you have a catheter. You and I should not get Social Security, Preet. It's not, they call it Social Security tax.
This is veering in a slightly different direction. And I understand means testing and I understand all of that. I also understand that programs remain popular when they're universal, not when they're means tested. So there's a political aspect to this and I wonder how you think about that.
Look, I got Pell Grants. I think Pell Grants are a hugely popular program. It was means tested because I came from a household that was in the lower quartile. So we means test food stamps. We means test a lot of things. I just don't think the right, just as I don't think the right litmus test for affirmative action is race, I don't think the right litmus test for the greatest transfer of capital. Think about the amount of money here, $1.4 trillion, 115 million households. So say 30 million households, lowest quartile, are really struggling. What is that, $40,000 you could give to each of the lowest quartile of households? And instead, a lot of people need Social Security. They should get it. But for a lot of people, it's an upgrade from Carnival Cruises to Crystal. And I don't understand why young people – here's a stat, Preet. In 1990, we spent $1 on kids for every $3 we spent on seniors. And you think, oh, my God, that's crazy. We're spending $3 on seniors for every $1 on children. Fast forward to 2019 – it's 8-1. In 10 years, we're going to spend more money on the federal government on seniors than anything else. They're going to take over 50% of our budget. And the reality is seniors are expensive and unproductive. So if you stop investing in youth, where does the country go from here? Like how you have young people who are enraged, depressed, obese, prone to self-harm, but seniors are doing great. And I'm not suggesting we should do away with Social Security. I believe in a transfer of wealth. But I think that the upper quartile of seniors that, quite frankly, just don't need it shouldn't get it. I'm not only about means testing. I'm about redistributing that capital. Why should a kid – 1 in 5 households has a kid that is food insecure. And we have seen child poverty go up. So this is a question of priorities. The question is, should the criteria for a transfer of wealth be age or be needs-based? And I think it should be the latter.
Do you have a view, given what you're saying, about the universal basic income as a solution to poverty in some places? It sounds like you would be against it, right?
I just spoke at TED, and Andrew Yang was there, and I consider myself a friend. And I like that Andrew, I think Andrew had a big impact normalizing that conversation, because if we'd had a conversation about UBI 4 years ago, people would immediately call it the S word. They say it's socialism. We transfer wealth all the time, or capital all the time. I think he screwed up in terms of branding. I think he should have called it a negative income tax. And that is, I think below a certain income level, a household should just get help. And so I'm not for universal basic income. What I'm for is basic income. He should have called it BI or a negative income tax. But the bottom line is, in the wealthiest nation in the world, where we can grow the economy by $250 billion in the 5 minutes post the earnings call of NVIDIA, there's just no reason for people to live in poverty. There's no reason for people to be homeless. And there is definitely, it is inexcusable for any child to be hungry in this nation. And the sad part, Preet, is that we have the resources. The incumbents will plead complexity that, oh, these are network problems or globalization. Every one of these problems has been fixed in other nations with fewer resources than us. We've just decided that people of my income and my age should pay an average tax rate of 17%, which has been my tax rate for the last 10 years, while we continue to keep minimum wage at $9 for young people and not give them child tax credits. This is a purposeful transfer of wealth from young to the old.
Yeah, look, I don't think it's a function of complexity or resources, but more a function of will, and that doesn't get talked about as much.
And also, does Speaker Pelosi really relate to the issues facing a young man on a gambling app or a 17-year-old girl that's getting extreme dieting tips from Meta when she's 5'7", 95 pounds? When Speaker Pelosi, and this is ageist, but biology is also ageist, when Speaker Pelosi had her first child, Castro declared martial law in Cuba, and 2/3 of households didn't have a color television. And I'm suggesting that the oldest elected populace in the world perhaps doesn't relate to the challenges facing young people. And also, kids and young people don't vote. So we continue to transfer wealth from the young to the old. And it's a self-fulfilling downward spiral. It is mutually assured destruction when young people are unhappy and enraged. It's not sustainable to have the basic social compact is that if you play by the rules, your kids are going to do better than you. And for the first time in our nation's history, that compact has been broken.
So may I pivot? May I use that term? Use that term with you, Scott?
Loosely, promiscuously.
Pivot for a moment, because you talk about wealth. What's your definition of wealth? What's the difference between making a lot of money and being rich?
Well, so on a very basic definition, the definition of rich is the following. Now, I have a close friend who runs a 700-person division at a large investment bank. He makes between $5 and $9 million a year. Between really high tax rates in New York, where the workhorses who make all their money from current income get taxed at plus 50%+, between his ex-wife alimony, master of the universe lifestyle, flex jet card, home in the Hamptons, he spends almost all of it. I would describe him as poor. My father, between his Royal Navy pension and Social Security and the money he collects from washing machines, that he owns a few washing machines at trailer parks, he makes $58,000 a year, him and his partner, and they spend $48,000. He's rich. He's got passive income greater than his burn. That's the definition of rich. And then so rich is really a function of just not having to worry at night that the music might be turned off and that you get to a point where you can support your lifestyle without working. The difference between what I found between wealth and extreme wealth is, quite frankly, is character. And that is, key to maintaining wealth and growing it to extreme wealth is not losing money. And the fastest way to lose 60% of your net worth is something I went through, and that is divorce. In addition, show me a smaller or medium-sized law firm or business that goes from doing really well and thriving to blowing apart, and it's usually a professional divorce. Usually the partners are not getting along. So wealth is a full person project, and that is, if you don't bring character, forgiveness, love, empathy to your personal and professional relationships, it's unlikely you're going to be very wealthy. And this trope, this Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren-like mythology that all billionaires crawled over people to get to where they are, is entirely untrue. The majority of very wealthy people, unless they were born wealthy, got there because they collected allies along the way. They were good people. And one of the keys to wealth is to try and be as generous and as high character a person such that people put you in a room full of opportunities even when you're not there. So you want to be really wealthy, bring forgiveness and generosity to your relationships.
Look, that was one of the most interesting things and points from your book, and you just uttered a version of it. I'll read what I thought was fairly striking in the book. Quote, "Stoicism is not just about remaining calm in the face of temptation. It means," and you said this a second ago, "it means having good character." And this is the line that struck me. "Succeeding in life is much easier if other people want you to succeed." End quote. How true that is, and why do we forget that?
Greatness and wealth is in the agency of others. You know, I've had a lot of businesses fail. I had a marriage fail, and I would one key to my success is the ability to endure rejection and get up and not lose my enthusiasm. But a close second, or maybe first, is that I like to think I was a good friend, a good business partner, a good person to invest in, even when I lost their money. And people were always willing to help me out. You got to have people who are thinking about you. You got to have people who want to help you. You got to have people to give you the benefit of the doubt. And the way to aggregate those relationships is an investment. You know, little investments early in your life, reaching out to people, being nice. You hear about a job opening and you think, oh, you know, Lisa would love this job. And you try and do her a solid, right? And when I was young, I don't think I was inclined to help other people out. I don't know why. I just think I was so focused on me all the time. And similar to investing, if you make those little investments in people over your life, they compound and you wake up. And then when you need these people the most, they are just so there for you. So make investments, put a little bit of money away in your 401k and in stocks when you're young, but also try and make investments in other people and try and help them out and try and show that you're a good person. Forgive them. They act like a jerk sometimes. Forgive them. You know, they're going to remember that. And so I think that this is, like I said, you're never going to accomplish anything in isolation. The cartoon of Monty Burns, an introvert who's not nice to people, who runs the nuclear power plant, who becomes a billionaire, that's just not accurate. Show me someone who made a lot of money on their own. I'm going to show you someone who's collected a lot of allies along the way. Greatness and wealth are in the agency of others.
Yeah, but just to be clear, and I have some experience in this in my prior life, there are people who become wealthy or who are wealthy who are grasping, nasty, and scheming too, right?
Yeah, I would look, this gets deeper, but I think at a certain point, if you're not careful, if you don't have people around you who keep you grounded, question you, tell you the truth, it's easy to start making incremental decisions that are suspect, right? And that can lead to a very dark and ugly place. But look, the point of the book is, if you want to be wealthy, you need to start investing in other people. Not making investments, but start investing in other people. That's the quickest way to get there. And then there's a whole other talk show around trying to ensure you stay grounded. Don't believe your own press. Don't surround yourself with yes people who will nod and pretend that some of the decisions you're making that might be immoral or even illegal are somehow okay. Because to that point, everyone's nodding because you're rich and for no other reason.
Let's talk about the algebra. As you said earlier in the conversation, you think formulas are good? You have a formula here. There's an actual formula. Tell us what the formula is and why it makes sense.
Well, the first is focus. I think your 20s are about workshopping and finding something you could be really good at. And don't mistake hobbies for passions. I always say find your talent, not your passion. What do I mean by that? You want to find something you think you could be great at. And that's not easy. But once you find it, make sure it's in an industry that has a 90%+ employment rate. A lot of people think, I want to be an actor, I want to be in movies. SAG-AFTRA, which has the 180,000 most talented creatives and actors in the world, 87% of them don't qualify for health insurance because they make less than $23,000 a year. So hopefully lean towards an industry that has a 90%+ employment rate. Commit to the BS, the breaking through hard things, the certification, just the endurance to become in the top decile. Because what creates passion is mastery. Because mastery creates wealth, relevance, camaraderie, the ability to do things and have experiences that you never thought possible. And that will make you passionate about whatever it is. So find your talent and then commit to being focused on it and getting in the upper decile. And while Like, I found that taking care of my parents is, I'm passionate about it. That taking care of my kids is joyous. And then I play golf and or I'm a DJ on the weekends. So find something you're passionate, that you're good at, that has a 90%+ employment rate. The next thing, I call it stoicism, but it's really just discipline. Get a savings muscle developed when you're in your 20s. I'm not suggesting you need to save a ton of money, but at least learn how to spend less than you make. Because once you enter your prime income earning years, if you don't have the savings muscle, it doesn't matter. You'll spend all your money. I know a lot of people make a lot of money who spend it all. And there's a lot of very talented companies trying to hit you at the right moment to convince you that an upgrade from economy to economy comfort to business class is an investment in yourself. And you should do it right now for the low, low price of $200. So try and live a little bit below your means. Be a little bit of a stoic. Recognize that no one's concerned, as concerned with your stuff as you are.
Can we pause on that for a second,
sure,
Scott? Because you and I were having a conversation before we hit the record button. Could you address the issue of patience and compounding? Because I was telling you the story, which you thought I should repeat here, that when I was young, starting out in government and started having children, you know, three kids pretty quickly while I was a line prosecutor in the government, the federal government, and I thought I needed every dollar that I made. And I probably did, because we had a lot of bills. And my dad, from the old country, impressed upon me very, very strongly, and he's probably going to be listening to this, so thanks, Dad. He said, you know, you should max out in whatever the retirement plan is with the federal government, which is the TSP plan. And my recollection is it was 3%. You could put up to 3% aside pre-tax, and then the government would give you another 3% in matching funds. So it's free money from the government. I thought I needed that money. I debated my dad. He said, please just do this. And I did. And then I spent 17 and a half years in the government. And I never missed those few dollars every week because it wasn't a ton. But as I mentioned to you before, 20-something years later, 24 years later, I get my income statement. I get my balance statement. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So talk about compounding and patience.
Well, that's the next part of the equation is time. One of the flaws in our species, because for 98% of our time on this planet, we haven't lived past 35. The human brain has no ability to calibrate how fast time will go. And if you're 25, you're probably going to live right now another 80 years. And also, I mean, you and I can attest to this. It goes really fast. So if I had a magic box for you, and if you put $300 a month in this box from the age when you graduate from college and maybe get your employer to match it, and there's a lot of those types of programs and it grows tax deferred, and you don't look at it when you're our age, I'm not exaggerating, you have millions of dollars. So the question is, would you make the requisite trade-off to be able to put money into this magic box? And also, you need to recognize that although it's impossible to grasp, the next 30 or 40 years are going to go really, really fast. So do what Preet did. Any opportunity to invest in something, round up, force savings, taken out of your paycheck so you never see it, and anything where someone else, a corporation or the government, will match it and then let it grow tax deferred. Oh, my God, that's champagne and cocaine when you're older. So go
hard.
Are you on
that right now, Scott?
Not yet. That was last night, Preet. That's why I look the way I do.
Is that the whole equation? Simple as
that? No, and then the last thing is diversification. And where I screwed up, Preet, is I always went all in. I've always made a lot of money, but I used to go all in on my businesses or one stock or one sector. And that works really well when it's working. But in 2000, with the dot-com crash, I've always been in e-commerce. I woke up and had negative net worth. And then I'm like, I was still a relatively young man, no problem. So I worked my ass off for the next 7 or 8 years, again, all in tech. Great financial recession comes along, and I lost everything because I wasn't diversified. And that was about the time my youngest son came marching out of my partner. And I remember being so nauseous in the delivery room, and it wasn't because of the experience. It was a recognition that I had failed my son the day one. I could have just so easily diversified a little bit and had a lot of money, but I was always like, oh, this company, my e-commerce company that's going public is going to be huge. And I just went so all in. Diversification is your Kevlar. You can get hit by a bullet in the chest. You can have any one investment go to zero. But if you're diversified, it hurts, but it doesn't kill you. And what I see, I serve on a lot of boards right now. Whenever we do a financing, I'm the guy that tells management, sell some stock, take some money off the table, and put it in something that is totally unrelated to this. Diversification is risk-free growth. And a lot of young people don't appreciate just how powerful and how boring it is. If you have only one opportunity to invest in any one asset, people ask me all the time, what's the one thing I'd invest in? It's SPY, low-cost index funds that you, where you're not trying to find the needle, just buy the whole goddamn haystack. Because the wonderful thing about America is with population growth and with innovation, over the long term, the market is up and to the right. It's returned 11% since 2008. That sounds meddling to a young person. That means every 21 years, your income, your investments are going up eightfold. Diversification is the last one.
Yeah, look, you're making me feel better about my conservative and youthful economic decision. So the TSP retirement program, and then any money that I had over the years, which wasn't a lot until I reentered the private sector recently, is in the S&P 500. Or now, I mean, I wonder what you think about now, with interest rates being higher, you can get a pretty decent yield on a money market or on a CD. Is that sufficiently diversified?
Yeah. So this is where a robo-advisor, or if you have a lot of money, a paid financial advisor, but essentially the alternative investments community, those people advertising on CNBC or in Barron's, it's a grift. And that is, if you look at all mutual funds, hedge funds, and you bucket them all, they have underperformed the S&P by the amount of their fees. So the smartest thing you can do on a risk-adjusted basis is just to go into low-cost diversified index funds. And you will know somebody who is smart enough to invest in NVIDIA, made a ton of money, or takes pictures of their screenshots of Dogecoin when it goes up 30-fold. Assume you are not that person and recognize no one's taking pictures and posting to social their losses. If you pick any one stock, it has a 50.1% chance of going up that day. If you picked any five stocks in the S&P and you held on to them for 10 years, no one has ever lost money in the history of the markets. Time, diversification are just really, really powerful. So, you know, I say in the book, the good news is I know how to get you rich. The bad news is the answer is slowly. But don't make the mistakes I made. Be preet. Recognize that time is going to go fast. Be boring, low-cost, diversified index funds. Because you know what's awesome, preet? Is being our age, maybe being able to step in and help out our kids or help our parents or take, you know, stay at the Almond in Utah. I mean, that is really a lot of fun. And to not be able to do those things at this age would be, quite frankly, kind of soul crushing. And just with a little bit of discipline, a little bit of maturity at a young age, you can get there.
It's interesting. It sounds like we're talking about two things, right? One is you have your job, you have your career, whether you're a teacher or a police officer or a lawyer or a doctor, whatever you are. How do you take care of your finances over the long haul? Do you use this Scott Galloway formula equation or not? But then there's another class of people, and you belong in this in both classes, people who are in life and in their career trying to make businesses and be entrepreneurs and make money as their main job, as opposed to trying to, you know, take care of their wealth management on the side. With respect to this, that second group of people, what's the lesson to them? Isn't the American spirit about taking lots and lots of risk and trying to make money fast because you have a product that you believe in or a service that you believe in? In other words, how do you square this advice generally to the population about, you know, conservatism and diversification versus the entrepreneurial spirit kind of thing?
Look, when you're young, I've gone all in on businesses.
Yeah.
I've started businesses, and it's a fun conversation to tell your partner who just had two babies. I know I'm working 60 or 80 hours a week and can't see our kids, but guess what? I need another $100,000 of our life savings. I'm paying the company to work there right now. And it paid off for me. So being, you know, American, one of our core competences as Americans is how risk aggressive we are. Having said that, what I tell kids or anyone I work with who has the benefit of making a little bit of money early, or, you know, as soon as you can, diversify. If I had just... I own 20% of a publicly traded company, Breed. If I had just sold 25% of it and put it in boring index funds like you, when my first kid came along, I would have been fine. But instead, I'm like, no, we're going to the moon. Can I lever up and go all in here and show commitment? And I'm a baller. And recognize a lot of this is not in your control. The market dynamics will always trump individual performance. You will, you know, occasionally you will get hit hard if you're in the market long enough. So by all means, be risk aggressive with ideas and concepts and entrepreneurial. But the moment you have a little bit of money, hope you're wrong and sell some of the stock in your company that you're so excited about. And then hope you're wrong. Hope the thing goes to the moon. But take a little bit off the table and put it in different things. Always have a plan B. Always have a plan B, because 6 out of 7 businesses don't don't work. And every stock, you know, the markets go down. And if you're not in a position such that, let me put it this way, why wouldn't you have a plan B that ensures that maybe you don't sell a best-selling book, maybe you're not, don't have an album that goes triple platinum, maybe your app doesn't go public, but just in case any of those things don't happen, you're still fine. And it doesn't take a lot. Just diversify a little bit. Take some off the table.
What's one more piece of advice for folks from your book that we didn't get to?
The key to success, in my view, is to forgive yourself and be humble. And that is, you know, my story used to be raised by a single immigrant mother, and I overcame all these winds in my face to be a baller and be economically secure. And then as I got older, I realized I was kind of born on third base. Being born a white heterosexual male in the 60s meant access to free education, 76% admissions rate at UCLA, $1,200 a year, born into the internet economy. I mean, I just look back on it and I'm like, okay, maybe I wasn't born in the 99.9th percentile, but I was born in the 99th. So when you're doing really well, be humble. Realize a lot of your success is not your fault. And try and be a good person and diversify. You're never more prone to a big mistake as when you are after a big win, because you start believing your own press and think, oh, I'm good at picking stocks, or any business I start will work. I'm going to put all my money into my next business. Also, realize, forgive yourself. When you get shot in the face, business goes out of business, you have someone break up with you, you know, you get divorced. I've had all of these things happen to me. I've had a company go Chapter 11. I've been divorced, and I thought, okay, I'm never going to be able to make money again. I'm never going to find a relationship, have someone to share my life with. And recognize a lot of that is not your fault, and that the key to success is to mourn and move on, and to find the people and the meditation or the physical activity such that you can look in the mirror every day and say, I am the answer to a company's problems. I will make someone very happy. Life is not about what happens to you. It's about how you respond to what happens to you. Move through failure with a sense of enthusiasm. Mourn and move on.
Mourn and move on. That's a good final point, Scott. Congratulations again on the book. Everyone should pick it up and give it a read. The Algebra of Wealth, A Simple Formula for Financial Security. Mr. Scott Galloway, thanks again.
Thank you, Preet. My number, take my call, 4 a.m. You hear that phone. Pick it up, my brother. Pick it up.
I'm not cheap, sir.
For more analysis of legal and political issues making the headlines, become a member of the Cafe Insider. Members get access to exclusive content, including the weekly podcast I host with former U.S. Attorney Joyce Vance. Head to cafe.com/insider to sign up for a trial. That's cafe.com/insider. If you like what we do, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. Send me your questions about news, politics, and justice. Tweet them to me at Preet Bharara with the hashtag AskPreet. You can also now reach me on Threads, or you can call and leave me a message at 669-247-7338. That's 669-24-PREET. Or you can send an email to letters@cafe.com. Stay Tuned is presented by Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tadashore. The deputy editor is Celine Rohr. The editorial producer is Noah Azulai. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, and Claudia Hernandez. Our music is by Andrew Dost. I'm your host, Preet Bharara. Stay tuned.